Today's guest contacted Mind Talk because he wanted to share his story. We'll find out more in just a moment. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. And I'd like to welcome Brian Spence. Brian, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Brian, tell us a little bit about how you came to contact Mind Talk.
Well, I was going through Facebook, and I came upon a little article that mentioned you, and I clicked on it and went into it. And I saw that you were looking for people who might be able to help other people in recovery, and I fit that bill, so I decided to try it. And here we are.
So it was a pretty simple path once you were introduced to Mind Talk.
Yes. Yes, it was very simple. Your producer called me, and we chatted for a little while, and seems like a very nice man. And we got along, and he said I'd be a good fit.
Well, you actually are a good fit. And let's begin with your story. You have indicated that you are 56 years old and in recovery. But you also said that you were surprised that you had made it this far. So let's go all the way back to your beginnings. Tell us about where you were born and who lived in the household with you.
Well, I was born in Buffalo, New York, and that's where all of my relatives are, on my both sides of the family. And for some reason, my father decided to move us to Poughkeepsie, New York. And that's where I grew up, in that area. Eventually, we wound up in a little town and not too far from Poughkeepsie. And I was introduced to drugs and alcohol at a very early age. And the little town I grew up in was the 70s, keep in mind, and everybody partied. I even went to parties at some of the teachers' houses in the summer. It was quite an experience.
It sounds like quite an experience. Who was in the house with you? You grew up with your dad, and who else?
I grew up with my dad, my brother, and my mother. My brother is also in recovery. My mother and father were very hard drinkers, fought a lot. I'd say they were alcoholics, but they stopped drinking after a while. And but I guess, you know, I didn't know what it was like to be normal. And like they say in the recovery, I didn't know that I didn't know.
Well, and that makes a lot of sense. You said that you were introduced to drugs and alcohol pretty early. How early is early?
Yes. Well, in fifth grade, man, I only had the one sibling, my brother, who's also in recovery. I don't know if I mentioned that. He's 7 years older than me, and he had me smoking pot, and him and his friends would laugh at me when I was in fourth, fifth grade. And alcohol was easily available, and it just progressed from there. And yeah, I didn't start out an alcoholic right away, but I never did anything socially. I drank for effect from the get-go.
When you say that your brother introduced you to pot when you were in the fourth or fifth grade, did anybody know what was going on, that you were actually using pot?
Well, I was smart enough not to tell the teachers or anything like that, but my friends and, my parents didn't know, but they suspected. They know my brother was in that area. They tended to look the other way a lot. As long as we weren't bothering them, they didn't really care.
So they never specifically asked you if you were doing drugs or alcohol?
Not really, no.
And you said that alcohol was easy to come by. Was that because your parents kept it in the household, or were there some other sources for you?
Well, it was constantly in the household, even more so on the weekends, and even more so if a relative from out of town came around. Yeah, and it was fairly easily available. We did all the things that most kids do. We raid the liquor supply and fill them back up with water, the bottles back up with water. And in high school, people would bring it to high school, and it was everywhere.
And it was everywhere, and parents didn't say anything to you in particular. What about teachers? Were you drinking and drugging every day or just on the weekends, or how did that happen?
Well, we were pretty much smoking and doing everything every day, and some of the teachers did it as well. And like I mentioned before, a couple of times over to the parties, I had been to keg parties at teachers, and over the summer I had been to keg parties at teachers' houses, and people were using it freely there, and students and teachers alike. So it was a pretty dysfunctional area. Everybody partook.
It just sounds so extraordinary that you would be at teachers' houses and everybody would be smoking and drinking and doing whatever. But from what you've said, that's just the way it was. That was normal. That was normal.
I proceeded to get DUIs, plural. Well, up there they're called DWIs. And I proceeded to get a lot of them up to the point where it sent me to prison.
So you indeed.
And that was just, again, that was normal. Like, everybody was getting them. Everybody was drinking and driving. It was just getting caught. Not getting caught was the main goal.
So the goal was not to stop. The goal was not to get caught.
Right. And I just happened. Many of my friends did it on a regular basis and never got caught. I was the unlucky one that got caught for everybody, enough for everybody.
Did you start to drink at around the same time that you were introduced to pot, or did that come before or after?
Well, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to drink. I mean, I used to see my parents sit around and they'd have such fun playing cards and laughing and drinking. And there's a movie, a gangster movie, and where they're all sitting around playing cards and laughing. I don't know if you've ever seen it now. Goodfellas?
Yes.
That was us. That was my family, minus the crime. That's what they did on the weekends a lot, was just sit around and laugh like that and have fun. And it was a goal I aspired to drink and have fun. Most kids were looking forward to going to college and getting their license, and I was looking forward to being able to go into a bar and drink legally.
The household that you grew in, as you described it, clearly there was at least chaos produced by alcohol, just in terms of the ways in which it was consumed. How did this affect, I mean, this was your daily life. How did this affect your grades in school?
I just went for the most part, and the teachers just passed me. For the most part, I didn't do any work, and they didn't want me around because I was labeled a difficult child from an early age. Turns out I had ADD. They didn't know a lot about it back then. Would have been nice to find out if it was diagnosed. Maybe my life would have turned out different, but who knows?
Well, when you were drinking, are you aware of a difference in the behaviors in which you engaged relative to the ADD? Did it sort of calm the behaviors or?
I never thought about that. I don't think it affected it one way or the other. To this day, I don't have the HD part, but I do have the ADD part. It's like, my mind is all over the place, and I wish there was something I could do about that. I could slow it down sometimes, but it still affects my learning capacity.
Have you ever thought about working with a clinician to help you with either medication and or some behavioral tools that would be useful?
Yes, I'm all about trying to improve myself, and you know, I read books, and I when I see clippings of shows like yours, I investigate because I want to enlighten myself. Not enlighten, wrong word. I want to grow spiritually. Because there's a lot of things out in this world that bother me, and I don't like to let it bother me because there's just nothing you can do about it. So,
well, it really, it might be useful. I mean, there are certainly medications that can be useful with...
Oh, I take 100 milligrams of Zoloft every day.
And do you find that helpful?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was sober for... about two and a half years this time. I'm coming up on six now.
That's
and
great.
I was still miserable and I was still depressed. And I was, thanks to my own research and going to outpatient, stuff like that, it finally dawned on me that my brain wasn't producing the correct amount of serotonin and dopamine. So I as much as I rebelled against it, because I don't like taking anything now, I tried it and the effect was almost immediate with me. It was like, it was amazing. I started feeling a lot better. I still don't feel 100%, but it's a lot better.
Good. That's
that
good.
That coupled with counseling has done a lot for me.
That's good to hear. Tell us about when you first began drinking. I'd like for the listeners to understand the progression of the alcohol consumption. So if you, for example, started drinking, what did you start drinking? What was it?
Beer. At first, okay. Whatever I could get my hands on, really, because I was underage and whatever was around, really. Can remember my first real drunk was on Amaretto. And man, did that get me sick.
I can understand that. And how much were you drinking when you first started drinking beer?
Well, I couldn't get at it on a regular basis, or I would have done it. And I don't think I was an alcoholic right from the get go.
Sure.
You know, like they say, there's an imaginary line we cross, and I don't think I crossed that line until I was like, I don't know, late 70s. Or late 16s, early 17s, I think I crossed the line. Even though I drank problematic. I was a problematic, you know, problem drinker.
What about dating while you were in high school? What impact did your drinking have on your dating, if you dated?
Well, there wasn't too much of that. We just pretty much ran around and did whatever we felt like, and most girls, you know, we were the trouble kids, and most girls didn't want to mess with the trouble kids, so there wasn't too much of that.
So you just kind of hung around with your buddies and drank and kind of did your thing.
That's it.
And
skip school.
Were you able to complete high school?
No, I dropped out in ninth grade.
In ninth grade. And did anybody from the school, or did your parents, did anybody come to talk to you or your folks about the fact that you were dropping out in ninth grade?
No, actually, they were like good riddance.
The school.
It's not like it was today. They didn't, I mean, we had school counselors and stuff, but it wasn't like it was today. When you were too much trouble, they just wanted you gone.
So you stopped going to school, and that was fine by them?
Oh, yeah.
And your folks, did they realize that you had stopped going to school?
Well, yes, they did. I went to L.A. not too long after that. My parents thought a change of menu would do me better, and I went out to Los Angeles, and that didn't work. My mother had a cousin out there, and I was about 16, 17. And like I said, that didn't work. So a bunch of my friends, the same friends I partied with in high school, a bunch of them had went to Houston. And that's back when Houston, Texas was booming. And I flew down there and it really progressed my disease during that 3 years I was down there.
And in Houston, you were staying with your friends.
Yes, and my brother was there. There was a whole bunch of us there from the area.
When your folks sent you to live with a relative, what understanding did they give you about why they were doing that?
Well, they said it was because they wanted to get me out of the environment I was in, and that was true in a way, but I think it was also because they wanted to get rid of me, too, because I was too much of a handful. I was, they never knew what was going to happen next. And they just, you know, they didn't abuse me or anything, but they couldn't be bothered. You know, if I wasn't causing any problems, they didn't care what I did. You know, it didn't matter when I came home, didn't matter when I got up, it didn't matter.
What did you think about that? That you could do whatever you wanted and your parents didn't interfere?
Well, at the time I thought I was lucky.
Okay.
I realize now, not so much.
But as a teenager, that was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. I was liking that.
And of course, with the experience of ADD, well, nowadays they refer to it as ADHD, but for you, you didn't have the hyperactivity piece. But that would make it that much more complicated. So being able to do, it would make it complicated for your parents because they wouldn't understand. And I would guess that they sort of blamed you for the impact of your ADD on your behavior and your learning. Did they?
Not too much. A little bit, you know.
Okay.
Say, a lot of it, I have trouble with dates and remembering a lot of things. You know, it's some things that are irrelevant I can remember with no problem, and then some things that I should remember I don't, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. So they didn't really get on you about that. Actually, it doesn't sound like they got on you about much of anything.
No, they didn't. They used to knock my brother around pretty good, but for some reason, I don't know, because I was the baby or whatever, they didn't bother me.
Did they ever blame your brother for any of your behaviors?
No. No, my brother was the golden child.
He was the golden child.
Yeah, he was big sports guy, and he was breaking record, state records, and for track and high jump, and he was working and doing all the right things. Me, I was pretty much the polar opposite. I didn't work and drank a lot, and he wasn't much different for me in the partying aspect. He partied a lot too, but you know, I don't know.
Well, you know, it's hard to live in a household with a sibling and you feel like you have to live up to that sibling in some way, or somebody wants you to, quote unquote, live up to that sibling. Brian, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue our conversation. Folks, stay where you are. This is Pamela Brewer, and you're listening to Mind Talk.
Thank you.
Brian, as you were growing up, dealing with all the experiences that you've just described, what was your sense of how you saw yourself as a young boy and as a young man?
Well, I never had very much self-confidence, and I had a lot of fear. There's always a tension around my house. You know, you never knew what my father was going to be like when he came home from work sometimes, if he was drinking. And, you know, and both of my parents, like I said, were heavy drinkers, probably alcoholics, but I can't say that for sure. But I never had much self-worth and a lot of fear. But the alcohol took that fear away.
What were you afraid of?
I don't know. Pretty much everything,
Okay.
and to this day, I still have it, you know, a little bit.
Okay.
New experiences, you know, first days at work, stuff like that. Am I going to be able to catch on? This, that, and the other thing. I put myself in quite a conundrum, with my actions over the years, and in the working area. You know, I'm a 56-year-old man, and I'm out there trying to compete with young guys now in assembly and whatnot. Maintenance, I mean, warehouse, and it's tough. My hands bother me, and
Yeah, it is tough.
it's not easy.
Talk about work. When you were in Houston, take us back to Houston. You were drinking, you were hanging out with your buddies. Were you working?
Off and on. Mainly, we were just partying. I fell in love with that city. You got to keep in mind that where I grew up, there was more dairy cows than there was people,
Gotcha.
and you know, and then the next thing I know, I'm neck deep in the fourth largest city in America, and I loved it.
Lots of guys, lots of girls, lots of bars, lots of stuff to do.
Oh yeah, and a pretty violent place too. You wouldn't watch your step, you'd get shot. I was stabbed down there.
Were you stabbed during a time when you were drinking or drunk?
Oh, we were in a bar.
Hmm.
These guys were jumped on my friend, a couple of them, bunch of them, and I went out there to help them. And I didn't realize it later until we got away and I looked down and my shirt was full of blood.
I hope you went to the doctor or a hospital.
Well, yes, we did because the friend I went out there to save, they had cut him up real bad. He had, they had to find a plastic surgeon from somewhere to reattach the tendons in his right arm. And he
Sounds
was down. They tried to kill him. Me too, for that matter. But it didn't what didn't matter to me.
didn't
I
matter to
mean,
you.
it was just a bump in the road.
Okay. Were there periods of time when you were sober and could reflect on the times when you were not?
Not really.
Okay.
The only time I was really sober is when I was in jail for some stupid reason, and I wasn't focusing on why I was there. I was focusing on when I could get out.
Okay. So you were.
Like I said, that was the norm.
So you were in and out of jobs, which was the norm.
Right.
Tell us about your first arrest that wound you up in. Well, it wouldn't have been your first arrest that would have sent you to jail, but tell us about those experiences, those run-ins with the law.
Well, there's been many. I have very long rap sheets in two states. I've been to prison in two states. And you know, there's nothing violent, and there's no drugs, you know, I never dealt or I never got caught with them. I used, but you know, I didn't traffic or anything. You know, when I'm in a good mood and they come to get me, and I'm the type of guy that could, I wind up with a whole bunch of tickets when, if I would have just acted normally, I would wind up with one. You understand what I mean?
Okay.
And then I'd get knocked around a little bit, and it was my fault. And like I say, that was the norm. That was what was expected. I mean, that's just what happened to my era there. The people in my era, like some people were lucky and they never had that. But I was an unfortunate one, and,
The first time you went to jail was when?
first time I went to jail was probably 77, 76.
What was the charge?
The charge was, we were really stupid, me and my friend and his girlfriend, and we had a friend who used to sneak into his mother's house, his grandmother's house, and grab some money out of her purse every now and again. So we figured we'd try it. And she was awake. And she didn't, I guess she was aware when he was doing it. But she saw us and freaked out and called the police, and it turned out to be a big deal. And we made the paper, and that's when they came and got me. And of course, I had, when I found out what was going on, I jumped on a bus and went down to Philadelphia. And then next thing you know, I didn't know, but next thing you know, I was a what do you call it? And the U.S. Marshals have to come get you.
Okay. So the U.S. Marshals came for you in Philadelphia.
No. I'm just saying there's a term for people who flee, when they know that there's a warrant out for them. But I came back and turned myself in.
You did. Okay.
I was only 16, 17. I had nobody giving me really good advice, and if they did, I probably wouldn't have listened anyway.
So is that the first time you were sent to jail when you were 16 or 17?
Yep. And my father bailed me out.
Was it jail or was
Yeah,
it a
one of the.
juvenile detention center?
No.
It
It
was
was
jail.
hardcore jail.
Wow. And the charge?
Oh, jeez. Well, like I said, it was a country area, so they kind of made us out to be like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Okay.
It kind of, I mean, we they it was the word was all over, big headlines in the paper, and our names posted, and so it was a higher felony. It was a C or a B felony. I
Okay.
mean, they made a big deal out of it, but I just wound up with probation. And I wound up being on probation the majority of my young adult life.
Huh. And how did you deal with probation? Was that helpful to you?
Now, once they used to make you go to AA meetings, and once I learned how to scan that, I never went to another one.
So while you were on probation, you were supposed to go to AA and I guess meet with your probation officer.
Right. I met with the probation officer. And that's where I learned that even if you stopped drinking the day before, they could still smell it coming out of your pores. So I had to try to stop drinking 2 days before.
So it sounds like the probation officer kind of taught you the tricks, knowingly or
Well,
unknowingly.
there was several of them. There was like I said, almost my entire young adult life was spent on probation of some sort. Or something. Mostly DUI. I have horrendous records, and they're mostly alcohol-related stupidity, traffic violations. That's what I went to prison for twice. Traffic violations.
Huh.
In March 12th of 1989, I went to prison. Well, I got the ticket that would send me to prison in New York for DWI, and that was back when they first started doing that, and nobody in the prison system believed that I was there for a DUI, including the COs. And eventually the inmates believed me, but the COs thought I was a plant to watch them.
Interesting.
Didn't make it fun.
I
Fun
can
anyway, but it made it.
certainly understand that. How long
I
were
had
you
to really
there?
watch my step.
How long were you there?
I was there for 18 months.
And this was a jail. This was prison. This was you and other adults and nothing
This was a
simple.
medium security prison in upstate New York, not too far from the Canadian border. The big time.
Nothing simple or
And
easy about it.
here I am in here for pretty much traffic violations.
And how old were you at that point?
At that point, I was about 26, 27 years old, and when they finally got me to where I was going, when I got done with the sentencing and all of that, and they brought me to reception, and then they chained me and hobbled me together with a busload of other guys, and after a 13-hour bus ride, I wound up there, and I got out, and that's where I had my first moment of clarity. I didn't realize what it was at the time, but I got to looking at all that razor wire and those fences and the guard towers, and that's when the thought came to me that if I stopped drinking, I'll bet you I'd stop winding up in places like this. And that I learned a few years later was a moment of clarity.
And that was the first time you ever really, sounds like, connected the effects of the alcohol with its impact on your life.
Right, drinking in trouble.
While you were in prison, what was that experience like?
Oh, that was horrendous. My girlfriend of 5 years had dumped me, and I couldn't blame her. But we had a toddler at the time, and so she was living with some other guy, and that really bothered me. And my mother, who was going through dialysis, she needed people to help her out, and I couldn't help her out. So it was really tough, and I got into 3 fights while I was in there, and it wasn't, and I didn't seek out any of them. But when you're confronted, you can't totally back off, and it's tricky navigating your way through those places.
Yes, indeed it is. And don't suppose there was any counseling, any help available for you.
No, not really. There were AA meetings in there, however, and that's when I had been forced to go to AA before, but never through probation, and I never had the open mind. And as a result of that moment of clarity I had, I started going to AA and I started listening. And they had outside speakers come in, and that's when I started connecting the trouble. And that's when I stopped drinking altogether for about 9 years.
So when you got out of jail at that point, you are on your way to 30. What did you
Right.
do in terms of work, in terms of relationships, in terms of living, in terms of staying sober?
Well, that night, when I got home, like I said, my mother was on bad shape. My father had already died, and my mother didn't have much money, and she was dialysis 3 times a week, and she kept getting infections, so she had to keep going back, and it wasn't pleasant. So when I, in fact, I had a tax return coming when I was in prison, and she asked me to give her some money so she could buy underwear. That's how bad off she was doing. She had to get money from her son in prison, you know? But anyway, I got out, and I had made up my mind I wasn't going to drink anymore. And that night, I called the AA hotline, and a friend of mine, Gary, came over to pick me up. That's where I first met him. And then we wound up being friends, but my brother and his girlfriend at the time came over, and he brought over a 12 pack of Bud and some weed and some other stuff and a bottle of champagne. And the look on his face when I told him, no thanks, I'm going to AA, was priceless.
He must
And
have been stunned.
oh, he was. And his girlfriend, because they knew me when, they didn't think they thought I was going to jump right back on the wagon, and no thanks. And it was very rough because it was a recession, and I had a parole officer who thought he was a Walker Texas Ranger. It was awful. And he
it
made me.
It doesn't sound pleasant at all.
Yeah. So yeah, it was a unique experience, but I got lucky and I found a job, and you know, I have angels, and they were guiding me.
Sounds like AA for you was really helpful at that time in your life.
Oh, it was. I mean, I had no clue as to what, you know, like I said, I didn't know that I didn't know. And when I got into AA and I started learning things, I was like, wow, you know, I didn't know you weren't supposed to take everything from your employer that you could, you know. And, you know what I mean? Like a lot of people do. You go to work for the state or something, the road crew, you bring home shovels, rakes. I didn't know. I didn't know you weren't supposed to badmouth somebody the minute they leave the room, right? Yeah. I didn't know if you didn't have anything positive to say, don't say anything at all. I didn't know these things. So it was a...
It sounds like it was that AA for you was a life changer and a lifesaver.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep, and then my brother followed me in. About a year later, he followed me in, and he stayed. And he's got almost, he's coming up on, I don't know, 25, 30 years,
wow,
something like that. And unfortunately, I had some things happen, and I had to test the waters again, and it wasn't pleasant. When they say you start off right where you left off, that's the truth.
You relapsed.
Oh, yeah. I relapsed from, like, 99 to 2013. March 13th, 2013 is when I got the DUI that would put me in a Florida prison.
And was that experience different from the first prison experience?
Oh, my God, yes. The difference between, I'm not saying New York is a good prison system, don't get me wrong.
I got you.
But if you keep your head down, mind your business, the COs will pretty much let you do your time. But in Florida, it's different. They, you know, they pick on you. They make up lies about you. You know, they won't leave you alone. They like poke you with a stick. Like, it's like, you know, it's just, you got to keep your head shaved. You got to shave every day. And they give you these razors that like tear the skin off. And they throw you in the box every chance they get. My 18 months in New York, I was never in the box once. In Florida, I was in it four times.
How long?
It's like, wow. Huh?
How long? In the box means in solitary.
Right. The first time was like 7 days because they put me on probation. And then I got out and I was late for a class one time. And I couldn't help it. I got a bit of a smart mouth. And when I was late for class, you got to go through this big gate. And there was this one CO there who wound up getting fired, by the way, for abusing narcotics. But anyway, he was a real SOB and he started yelling at me. He says, "Why are you late?" And I said, "I'm sorry." I said, "I just woke up." I said, "Why?" And he was yelling at me, spittle and food was flying out of his mouth. He said, "You want us to make up a personal thing for you so that we'll just come and wake you up, make sure you're..." I said, "Yeah, it would be nice." And off to the box again. And being how I was probation, on the last thing, they gave me like, I think it was 35 days.
Oh, my.
So, yeah.
Just a whole lot of trauma. And, you know, one of the things that we know about prison for many people is it doesn't help at all. It just kind of helps them to be worse. Brian, we're going to take a break. Well, and when we come back, we will pick up with what your life is like now.
Okay.
Don't go away, folks. We'll be right back. Brian, you've had the experience of being in jail multiple times, multiple tickets, multiple fights, multiple disappointments, I would think, in terms of the ways in which your life was laying out before you. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
What is your life like today?
Well, my life is a thousand times better, but I'm still struggling. From 99 to 2013, March 13th, which is a day after my original sobriety date. I don't think there's a coincidence there. I was in and out of AA, and I couldn't get it straight, and I couldn't get it straight. I couldn't get it. I couldn't get it. I couldn't get it. And then finally, it took something like this to knock me over the head and straighten out. And I try to tell when I share at meetings and stuff, I try to let people know it doesn't have to come to that, but it will. It's not a matter of if, it's when. It will come to that. And you don't have to do it. You can, if I can do it, anybody can do it. I got out of prison and I stayed sober. And I have been through, I also quit. Well, you can't smoke in Florida DOC. So I also quit smoking when they sent me in on August 8th. I was out on bail for a little while. And I said to myself, I'm going to make something good come out of this at least. So I quit smoking and I didn't start again when I got out. And thank God I haven't. It's amazing that I haven't even started smoking again with some of the things I've been through since I've been sober. And, life happens. A lot of things aren't easy. I lost a brother I never knew I had. Apparently, my father was promiscuous and he had another child and he got in touch with me before he died. And I mean, he got in touch with me. He was a Vietnam vet and pretty much a war hero. Did three tours over there and I got to meet him once. And then he died from emphysema. And and it was pretty bad. I would have liked to gotten to know him, but that's life. Things happen. My life now is my two kids. I have two kids from different marriages. Well, one wasn't a marriage, but neither one of them would talk to me for the longest time because, I took off and went to Florida and pretty much left them on their own, being the selfish alcoholic that I am. And maybe both of them would swear they'd never talk to me again. And that's changed. My oldest son is living with me now, and my youngest son is in the Navy, and we're on good terms. And I lost my license for life, and
Your driver's license.
That hurts. Right. I was driving tractor trailer,
Oh,
and
boy.
now I have to, like I was telling you, I have to go do these warehouse jobs and whatever and try to keep up, and that's difficult. But my life is a thousand times better right now, and I know if I don't drink and drug, it will continue to get better, but I'm still going to have setbacks. But I made up my mind I'm not going to drink no matter what. And it's just a day at a time.
And sometimes it's
Still.
just a moment at a time, I would think.
Oh yeah. I'm living in an area right now where, it's drug people. You know what I mean? It's not a ghetto or anything, but there's a lot of people who use drugs around here. There's a little store. I'm constantly surrounded by it. I got a couple people in my life that I try and help out, and I let them sleep on the couch. And try and get them into detox, and that makes me feel good. But they're not ready yet, so they keep going back out.
You have said that you certainly credit AA with being very valuable in your life, but you don't go as much as you used to. Can you talk about that?
After throughout the years, you get wiser, you get learn more, and I've learned that, I if you depend on AA to keep you sober, you're going to get let down eventually. If you make AA an addiction, it's not good. You don't go to AA to stay sober. Once you go through the steps and you rely on your higher power to keep you sober, your job is to go to AA and tell other people that they don't have to live like that anymore. You don't need it because you rely on something else. That's my take on it anyway. You're protected. You go there and you try and let people know that they don't have to live like that anymore. And that's why I like going to detoxes and sharing and rehabs. And I've been trying to get it. I've been thinking about going for a job in a rehab, but as a tech of some sort. But I don't have a license, you know, and I got a criminal record, so it holds me back. People say I should just go for it anyway, but
I agree. I absolutely agree.
Once again, that's that fear kicking in, you know.
Well, you know, people are afraid a lot of times of a lot of things, but your experience and your willingness to talk about it and go to detox and go to rehabs, that is powerful. And my guess is that despite the fear, because you can be afraid, but you can still put your name in the hat for a job at one of these facilities. My guess is that somebody is going to be delighted and grateful to have you. You have a lot of experience.
Like
you have a lot of experience and a lot of wisdom, and you're open in sharing your story. So,
I've been homeless, so I can relate to people like that. I go to soup kitchens sometimes and volunteer. I just like to give back. And I also like to try and better myself as a human being. I try to be a better person than I was the day before. I know these are all cliches, but for me, it works.
Brian, I really hope that you hear me and hear the people around you who are asking you to go for it and go for it. Don't wait until you're not afraid. Don't wait for that. You can be afraid, but still go and see what happens.
Okay.
It's a little scary, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So is being homeless.
Right.
You know,
and you survived it.
I talk to them people. I believe that's a choice because I've been there and I've worked my way out, you know. Went to shelters, got a job, sobered up, rented a room, you know, then shared an apartment. Then, you know, it can be done. You know what I mean?
You can pull
yourself out of the mire.
But
it's a good feeling once you do.
It is a good feeling. But as you yourself know, it can be scary to even allow yourself to think that your life can be different for some folks. And even as you think that it might be different, there's a fear of trying. But you've not let your fear of trying stop you. You have continued to try and to grow and to do what you need to do for yourself. And just the fact that you're now having a good relationship with your children speaks volumes. It speaks volumes to the person you are and what you've been able to overcome.
Well, thank you.
Does that make sense?
Really, but
does that make sense to you? You don't have to say anything, but
yes,
it does make sense. Okay, good.
But you know, the low self-worth never really goes away. Too, you have to work on that. At least I do. I have to work on that every day. Not every day, but
well, you do have to work on it because we are, as you well know. We are living in a world that is very skilled at helping people feel badly about themselves and less skilled at helping people feel positive about themselves and certainly positive in a sustained way. But think about all the things that you have survived. It's just amazing.
I also have trouble finding a good therapist. I need somebody. It's true when they say that an alcoholic, a recovered addict or alcoholic, will listen to another recovered person before they listen to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to find, you know, somebody. Like, I've been in day treatment places, outpatient, and you know, they got one little 23-year-old kid there who's fresh out of college, but he's an alcoholism substance abuse counselor. He's like, "Oh, I learned all I need to know from books." I said, "Well," I said, "I can learn all I need to know from being pregnant from a book, except for what it feels like." but
very true. Good point.
So that does matter to have people, you know, who've been through it and have come out the other side.
It does matter.
And the reason I say that I'm still surprised to be around is because, like, I've been shot at several times, and people, and my brother and I hang out. He's 7 years older than me, but we know a lot of the same people. And I'd say a lot of them are not here anymore because it's alcohol, drug related, you know, they're not here. ODs, car crashes related to alcohol, you know, murders related to alcohol, suicides, you name it, man. We've lost a lot of people to this disease.
And it is a disease. And many people, although far less, I believe, than in the past, but there are still many people who don't recognize that it is absolutely a disease.
Right.
There is treatment for it. There are ways to work within the individual to help overcome the practice of drinking, to soothe or cover or hide the other feelings, the other fears, the other anxieties. But as you've said, it's hard and it takes time.
Yep, and persistence.
Tell us about your romantic life these days. Is there a special someone in your life?
No. I guess that's not in the cards for me yet. Possibly not ready. It was a young lady, but for a little bit, but then she decided to go her own route. So, yeah, I can't blame her. It wasn't meant to be, that's all.
Well, I know that in the beginning of one's working with AA, they recommend that you not engage in an intimate relationship for a period of time. Did you ever pay attention to that advice?
It didn't really matter for me because it never happened, but okay. I wouldn't have. But if you can, you get to know yourself first. I think that's why I think my higher power has singled me out to keep me alone, to get to know myself. And that's what I used the time for, was I've been through therapy and, you know, I got on the antidepressants and I've been reading stuff online, and, you know, I've gotten to know myself and I'm trying to change. Some things are hard to change.
That's true.
You know, but
what have you learned about yourself that you really enjoy about you?
Well, that I really believe that about integrity. And to me, integrity is doing the right thing when nobody's looking. And I enjoy that about myself. I really try to be honest, and I don't lie. I used to, you know, lie a truckload. But I don't lie anymore. And, you know, the effort that goes into staying, keeping your sobriety is astronomical, I guess. I don't know. It's just not easy, but it is easy. It's, you know, it's a hard program for simple people. Or it's a simple program for hard people. How do they say that?
I'm not
anyway,
sure, but either way could work.
But it works. And if I can do it, anybody can do it. So I hope somebody got something out of this.
Well, as I said, I am very clear that the candor with which you have talked to us today really has been helpful to someone. And I'm, what's your immediate next step? What's your immediate next thing on your list to do?
Oh, I don't know. I want to find a stable job. I haven't been able to find a stable job for, and like I say, there's the market's not big for a 56-year-old guy with, bad hands and no license. I got this stuff called Deputrans Contractor, I think it's called Deputrans, and it's pulling my tendons in.
Huh.
And they can't do anything about it, I guess, until it gets really bad. And then they do something. I'm not sure what, but I have this job right now where I really have to use my hands. So it's
So that's not great. It
no.
really sounds like it would be wonderful for you to really put in the effort, acknowledging your fear of looking for a place where you could get a position in rehab, or a detox facility or a day treatment facility. I mean, there are so many places that are providing services and value the input of people who have actually lived the life. So I really hope that you move forward and just give people calls or send people emails, just like you did with MindTalk. You had no idea if we were going to respond, but you sent the email anyway.
Yep. And I did it because I wanted to, my motive was to maybe I could help somebody.
Well, and I am sure that you have helped someone with today's conversation, and I am really grateful, Brian, that you have called and that you have been so wonderfully open and forthcoming during our conversation today. Thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Thank you for having me. Can I say one thing?
Sure.
If anybody out there has any advice on how I could get to work in a rehab, could I give them my email address?
You can give them your email address, sure.
All right. It's BRIANSPENC69@gmail.com.
All right. And if someone can give you some help, I hope that they will send you an email.
I'm in Central Florida, but I can relocate.
Sounds good.
For that, I would.
I
For a
understand.
job in that field, I would.
Well, and I think you would do well with it, Brian, because
Okay.
your sincerity really comes through. Thank you again for joining us today. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. And you can get it on demand by going to myndtalk.org. You can sign up for the MindTalk program guide by going to the MindTalk website. The MindTalk has an app that you can download from Google Play or iTunes. Lots of places where you can pick up MindTalk on a regular basis. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, that's exactly what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.